Hello, I'm Jim Cornell, and this is the WalkingPost.com podcast. WalkingPost.com is the news website dedicated to walking, with all the latest on trails, gear, festivals, and more. This podcast, number 14, is airing on Friday, May the 30th, which is International Hug Your Cat Day. My cat, unfortunately, isn't much of a hugger. It's National Creativity Day, and it's also E-Bike Day. It's also World Multiple Sclerosis Day, definitely one worth paying attention to. I have no idea who any of the famous people are that were born on this day, and all of the events from May the 30th throughout history seem like they're all pretty bleak. Clearly, we study history because it's interesting, not because we learn anything from it. Apparently, this part of Scotland broke a record recently, with 35 straight days without rain. Now, the problem with this is that the rain doesn't like to be upstaged, so it is now attempting a 36-day rain streak, and so far it's doing pretty well. That means that the only walks that I got in this week were in the rain, and for mundane things like picking up my new glasses. I'm not sure how to deal with the excitement. I did think of one interesting thing for the podcast while I was making coffee the other day, but by the time I'd put the sugar in, I'd forgotten what it was. We did manage to do some filming indoors at a museum in East Ayrshire on Saturday, and that was very interesting, learning about the early days of Robert Burns. However, while I was filming, I was tapped on the shoulder 3 times and turned around and no one was there, which was definitely a bit odd. Of course, this has nothing to do with walking, so I've got no idea why I'm mentioning it. But I have had a couple of similar experiences while on hikes, and one of them was while walking with my mother in the Hatfield Forest, when I lived for a few months in Takeley in Essex, right at the end of Stansted Airport's runway. More on that maybe when I do a podcast on paranormal activities while hiking. Might be a short podcast. But I throw that out there because maybe there are listeners who have had similar weird experiences while hiking. If so, please do get in touch. It's an interesting subject. Although don't get in touch if that experience was the result of eating wild mushrooms. Last week our two subjects were the Jigiktek Seawall Hiking Trail in Nova Scotia in Canada, and also about the Mammoet Mountain School UK in Kendal, Cumbria. I shall be passing through Kendal on a train in a couple of weeks to go to the outdoor show in Liverpool. Although it's not outdoors, it's indoors. So the outdoor show is indoors. Anyway, hopefully I can get at least a couple of interviews for the podcast while I'm there. And I hope I get some Wi-Fi coverage on the train so I can listen to music. Although maybe I should just content myself with hoping that I get there, because it's always a bit worrying when you have 5 train changes to get somewhere. Maybe I'll end up in Preston or marooned in Glasgow. Hopefully I don't do what I did many years ago while I was in university at Leeds. Some friends and I went to a football game at night in Sheffield, and after the game we got the train back to Leeds. The only slight problem was that the train split in half, and the half that we were on ended up in Newcastle. And by the time we got to Newcastle, we'd missed the last train home, so we had to get a hotel in Newcastle. A bit of an expensive football game, that one. Enough about that, let me tell you who we have on the podcast today and what we're talking about. I'm feeling very responsible today because one of the interviews is about insurance. And no, not about how to read a contract, but about what kind of insurance you may need if you're on a walking or trekking holiday. That is an interview with Tim Riley, Managing Director of the True Traveller Insurance Company. And we will also be talking about the Coast to Coast Path Passport, something we had an article on recently, and that launched not that long ago. The interview is with Donald Klein, passport volunteer and a director of the Richmond Yorkshire CIC that runs the passport programme. Of course, before that, we do take a quick look at some of the week's articles over on walkingpost.com. And if you have news, press releases, guest ideas, and comments, please get in touch via walkingpost.com, or you can just email me at jim@walkingpost.com. Okay, so it's time for that brief look at some of the headlines of the news articles we had on walkingpost.com this past week. I guess it's not so much a look at the headlines as a listen. First up, the Tyne Derwent Way has celebrated a successful year. A new walk has been opened honouring an Olympic gold medalist. And this is not a clickbait website, so I can tell you it's in Northern Ireland, and the medalist is Lady Mary Peters, who won the pentathlon in Munich in 1972. Hypershell and the American Hiking Society have launched a partnership. There is a new Shropshire website that features more than 300 walks, and the UK's most walkable city is celebrating Walking Month. And again, the reveal, that would be Brighton, which was voted the best walking place in the UK, I think by Time Out. I must say I do like Brighton, other than the traffic when I used to live in West Sussex. An active travel manifesto has been launched with support from 50 organisations. Trails Day was a big success in the US, and if you like being one of the first to have something new, then head over to Kickstarter for a new piece of gear called Camper Kit, which is a piece of equipment that has power that you can attach different tops to, like fans or lights or chargers. It comes with 10 different tops. I'd really like one, but with all the recording equipment that I carry in my backpack, I'm not sure that I'd have the room. It does look great for camping, though. Anyway, you can read all of these articles and more at walkingpost.com. Okay, so let's move on to this week's conversations. First, we have a really informative chat about insurance. Do you get insurance when you go on a walking holiday? Do you even need it? What should you be looking for? Well, the answers to these and more can be found in the next few minutes in our conversation with Tim Riley, travel and tourism and insurance veteran, who is the managing director of travel insurance company The True Traveller.
So I guess the first thing then is if you could tell me a bit about the company that you're with.
Well, True Traveller was started up in 2010 by me and my business partner, Chris. And essentially, we come from a travel agency tour operator background. We first met at Trailfinders in the 1980s. So we've known each other a long time. And we'd both come to a stage where we were out of a job. Travel is a young man's game. If you're over 40, you can forget moving. So we started our own travel company. It was a travel company selling adventure holidays. People like Gap Adventures or G Adventures, it's now called, Exodus, Explore, Lodha Nepal stuff, Kilimanjaro stuff. And we got a broker we knew to set up an insurance scheme for us. Moving forward, we ended up selling a lot more travel insurance than we did actual holidays. And it got to such a degree that the travel authorities, like the Civil Aviation Authority, were saying, where's all this money coming from? So we were under a bit of pressure by them because they thought we were fiddling the books. So we eventually shut down the holiday side totally in 2014. And since then, they're purely been doing travel insurance. I mean, since those early days of insuring one person a day, you know, it's now we insure hundreds and thousands of people, you know, every week. We use AXA as our what's called our provider. So they're our insurer and they're very good. And over the years, you'll find that most intermediaries change insurance companies. But we're with AXA now. One of the reasons we like them is that everybody's heard of AXA. You get some travel insurance companies and they say, well, who's your insurer? And they'll come out with a name that you've never heard of. Whereas everybody's heard of AXA. So I was saying, if it's A or Z, like Allianz, AXA or Zurich, that's fine. And so on a simple stage, that's why we're with AXA. They listen to what we do. Their assistant side is very good. We do the claims, which we're very pleased about. It's always let us down in the past, having other people do our claims. So we do them now with Access money, and it works well. So we're happy. Tricky stages, obviously COVID was a disaster for everybody. Lots of cancellations, lots of people trapped abroad. But we were quite lucky because we have permission from AXA to sell insurance to people who are already abroad. And in COVID times, people were trapped abroad because all the airlines stopped flying and their insurance was running out. They couldn't get more insurance. Some insurance companies essentially folded. The post office stopped selling insurance in total for more than a year. But we could still sell it, even if people were abroad. So that, for us, wasn't too bad. Obviously, we didn't make any money in COVID. Nobody did. But we survived. So that was good.
Do most people buy holiday insurance or travel insurance?
Everybody, every so often, somebody will do a review, but it's generally recognized about 70% of people travel with insurance and 30% of people go with nothing. There is what is called the Global Health Insurance Card, EHIC, it used to be known as when we were in the EU. It's a bit of an anomaly because it's not global and it's not insurance. All it will do is give you the health scheme available in that country, the national health scheme. So it doesn't cover cancellation of your trip, doesn't cover flying you home if you get very sick. And obviously in some countries, and it's only European countries it covers, or most European countries, not all. And in some cases, it's a bit of a misnomer. Travel insurance for Europe is very cheap. You can get a weekly policy for Europe for £6 or £7. And it's a numbers game, essentially. I mean, the insurance companies don't want to lose money. Some years they do, obviously, but your premium is going towards paying everybody else's claim. So if you don't claim, great. But, if you do have to claim, a minor visit to a doctor, for example, let's say, you're in somewhere in Europe, or let's go to the States. So you go into a walk-in clinic in the States because you've got, a minor issue. You're looking at $120, basically. But if you go to an ER in the States, if you break your arm or break your leg or in an accident, say in Florida, California, that's a $10,000 visit. So you really want to get insurance. Silly. I mean, a lot of people get it with their banks. So some banks, if you've got a certain account with them, you'll get insurance. Some people get it with certain types of credit cards, you'll get insurance. But the important thing is to read the cover and make sure that you really do have it. For example, some credit card covers will give you insurance if you buy your holiday with that credit card. But if you don't buy it with that credit card, you don't get any cover at all. I've always found bank insurance tricky and dangerous because you've really got to know what you're doing to look at it. I mean, I use my bank insurance and I have read the cover from start to finish to make sure that it's going to work for me. But in certain trips I'll go on. I mean, for example, I went to a Peru a couple of years ago and I was doing some high altitude trekking. I didn't want to go with a bank insurance just in case I had a problem. I wanted our insurance. So I decided that was a safer bet to do. But luckily, I didn't need any insurance anyway. I was fine.
Does travel insurance vary by destination?
Costs vary enormously. The biggest costs we see is in North America, and that's why travel insurance to the States and Canada is more expensive than anywhere else. There's two issues in North America. First one, we all remember Obamacare, the Affordable Health Act in the States. That basically moved a lot of money out of the system. So hospitals in North America, which are all private essentially, are very short of cash. So they will hit foreigners double the rates that an American will pay. That is an issue. Also, the costs of getting people back from the States if they're very poorly. We had an accident in Lubbock, Texas in October time-ish. A guy in a rental car at some traffic lights and a truck jumped the lights and smashed into the side of his car. He was lucky in some way. He broke a lot of bones in his body, but he luckily didn't have any internal injuries. So we could actually fly him back quite quickly within about 10 days. But the cost of the air ambulance was $160,000. So, it does add up. There's other countries which are cheaper. Thailand, for example, is pretty good value for medical attention. And it's good. It's quality. Places like Cambodia, Laos, Vietnam, not so good. So if there's a big injury in those countries, we'll generally stick them on a plane and move them to Bangkok. And obviously, places like Australia, New Zealand, extremely good. South Africa, good, but expensive because Russians are buying the hospitals out there. And obviously, as you would imagine, sub-Saharan Africa, et cetera, most of South America, pretty poor. So it's useful then to fly people to what we call a centre of medical excellence, where they'll be treated properly in a case of a serious injury or accident. But in most parts of the world, you know, the big claims is very rare. 1 in 10 people, 1 in 12 people will need to claim on their insurance for something, whether it's a lost bag or lost cash or, you know, a minor medical ailment. And mostly for minor medical stuff, you do exactly what you do in this country. You'd go to the local pharmacist and say, hey, I'm not feeling well. What do you suggest? The pharmacist will say, I think you should have this, 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 or this. Or they'll say, go to the hospital. Just do what you would do at home.
Good advice. I guess a lot of people think that you just buy insurance, but is it a one size fits all, or should people be looking around according to the destination and what they're going to be doing on holiday, that kind of thing?
Travel insurance is probably one of the most complicated insurance contracts you'll ever buy in your life. You think of the simple stuff, car insurance. If I crash the car, they'll fix it. Simple. Really simple. You don't need any training for that. You don't really need to read anything. You understand it's fully comprehensive. They'll fix my car. If I've only got third party insurance, they're only going to fix the other guy's car and not mine. So that's pretty straightforward. With travel insurance, though, there's so many sections. Medical is the main one, the big ticket item. I mean, if you lose something, you'll get over it. But medical is the main thing. But then you've got to look at this liability cover. So quite literally, if you walk into a shop and knock something over, the shop owner is going to sue you. We get a lot of it. It's bizarre. We have very clumsy people. Likewise, Airbnb, you drop a glass of red wine on the sofa and you ruin the sofa. They're going to want a new sofa out of you. So they'll use their travel insurance for that liability aspect of it. Also, it's what you're doing. Most or all travel insurers will cover you sitting on a beach with your little drink, with your umbrella in the top of it, having a nice little drinky on the beach, as long as you drink a reasonable amount. Obviously, if you're so drunk, you don't know what you're doing, you could run into problems then if you try and do a claim. But if you're climbing, doing high altitude trekking, if you're abseiling, riding a quad bike, then you're going to have to check the small print. Although it's not small, everybody talks about the small print in insurance contracts. It's always the same size. It's pretty big. And also on websites now, they make it really obvious. I mean, it's changed a lot over the last 5 or 6 years because the regulator has, you know, made us all up our gains. I'd like to think our game was always up anyway. So people are kind of catching up with us now about what it is. But yeah, you should check things out. It is, you know, people just think, oh, the insurance is only going to cost £10. And there are a lot of people out there who think their insurance covers everything, regardless of anything. It doesn't. It basically tells you what you are covered for, not what you're not covered for. But again, when it comes to activities, do what you would do at home. I read in the newspaper the other day about a guy, a soldier, who was in Thailand and he fell down a waterfall and he's very, very badly injured. And it's not clear if he had travel insurance. I don't think he did have travel insurance with anybody. But this waterfall, he was trying to take a selfie and he was standing at the top of the waterfall on very slippery rocks with water going over it. And there's probably some green slime, the most slippery sort of stuff you can find. And if you were sort of standing on a weir at home on a river with fast flowing water, you just wouldn't do it. But he did it and he's in a very, very sad way. He has a GoFundMe page open now to try and get him back home because he needs an air ambulance and he's not going to jump onto British Airways to fly home because BA just aren't going to let him because he's very, very poorly. So, you know, that's a six-figure claim there. So do read what you're doing. If you're not sure, if you're not very happy about reading policy documents or websites, phone up the insurer and they'll answer the phone and the guys on the end of the phone know it backwards. And obviously, if they give you the wrong advice, all phone calls are recorded, etc. It's a very highly regulated business. So, you know, we have regulators. We've got to give them reports and phone recordings, etc. And just say, hey, I'm climbing Kilimanjaro. Will your insurance cover me? And you'll just get a yes or a no straight away. And that's what you should do if you're not happy. But all travel insurance policies is different.
Is walking or trekking considered to be more of a risk?
At altitude, yeah. At altitude, anything under 2,500, 3,000 meters is fine. So, you know, most walks in Europe, for example, are absolutely covered fine, and most treks in Europe. But once you get over altitude, you generally get two issues. First one is acute mountain sickness. And the second issue is that if you do get in trouble, you're probably going to need a helicopter to get you out of there when you're at altitude. And that's when the costs jump. We think about skiing holidays in Switzerland, there's always a helicopter, etc. But if you have a musculoskeletal injury on a trek, you go over your ankle, break your ankle, etc., etc., they're not going to send a mountain rescue team with a stretcher and walk you back down. They're going to send a helicopter to get you. And that suddenly, within Europe, that sort of helicopter, you're looking at 6,000 euros from the get-go. Trekking, absolutely. There's treks and there's treks. There's going for a long walk, and that's fine. But as we know in this country, every so often, you get people going on walks on Brecon or in the Scottish Highlands, and they're not properly equipped for it. They don't have the right equipment. They don't have the correct walking shoes or walking boots, and the change in weather, and exactly the same everywhere else. So yeah, you've got to prepare properly, and you've got to make sure you've got the right cover just in case. And don't forget, musculoskeletal injuries, 95, 96, 97%, you're going to be absolutely fine. But with all our claims that we get, more often than not, it's just people in the wrong place at the wrong time.
Obviously, like if you just went for a walk around Paris or a day walk, that wouldn't really make any difference. But if you were going specifically to, say, walk one of the e-trails for 2 weeks, would that be considered different if you were doing it as a walking holiday?
Not really. Again, it's the altitude. But walking around Paris for a whole day, or walking around any city for a whole day, and my wife drags me around cities walking, and she's a freak about public transport as well abroad. But road traffic accidents, getting hit by a car. I was in Vietnam last October, November time, and there's so many motorbikes on the road. I mean, in Hanoi, it is nuts. I think the population of Hanoi is 10 million, but there's 14 million motorbikes. You've never seen anything like it. And there's, you know, you've got to look at YouTube to work out how to cross the road, because you know, there's no left and right hand side of the road, and there's no traffic lights, or nobody pays any attention to anything. Yeah, it's the just in case thing. As I said, the big accidents and the big problems, and we do a lot of business on to Nepal, trekking in Nepal, Kilimanjaro, Akonyonde in South America, etc. Big treks, tricky treks, over 6,000 meters. But the big claims are just a mixture of just wrong place, wrong time, hit by a car, twisting an ankle, etc. And then suddenly, you know, wherever you are, that can mean quite big bucks to get you.
The companies that run those treks, are they aware of, and do they help people get insurance, or is it basically they're just selling the holiday and it's up to you?
Generally now, they will recommend you take travel insurance, and they may, you know, refer people to one or two or three different travel insurers to check. And they should do. And a lot of treks, particularly in Nepal and Kilimanjaro, they'll ensure that you have travel insurance, so they may not take you on the trip at all. Travel agents now and tour operators, they don't really sell travel insurance now because it's a regulated activity. Back when I was a travel agent in the 80s and 90s, anybody could sell insurance. And of course, you just got terrible advice because the travel agent wanted their commission, which is a lot of commission for selling you an insurance policy. So eventually the FSA, it was then called, turned around and said, look, sorry, guys, you just can't sell travel insurance anymore because you're giving wrong advice. It's only the insurance companies or regulated firms can do that. Yeah, so everybody who sells you travel insurance now must be regulated with the Financial Conduct Authority. They've got to do training courses and be properly insured themselves. But you've got to look out for yourself. It's like anything. Nobody's going to warn you and tell you to do something. So you've got to, you know, accept some responsibility and think, actually, am I going to be okay if such and such a thing happens? And it's not just the holiday itself. If you're, you know, they say you're doing the walking the Pacific Trail in the States, which is going to take you a few months, with the cost of your accommodation and flights and all the rest of it, by the time you get there, you know, you'd have probably spent the fat end of £10,000. If you broke your leg the day before you were going to go, you're going to lose all that. The airline's not going to give you any money back. The tour operator's not going to give you any money back. But that's why you need your travel insurance, because you can claim it back from your travel insurance. So, you know, even before you go, and, you know, you get a lot of cancellations, sort of bizarre reasons. You know, people's obviously a close relative dies, your mum dies, your dad dies, your house burns down. Yeah, cancellation claims. It's quite a big thing. I think after medical, cancellation's the next biggest as far as payouts go.
you're mentioning the big things that can happen, but sometimes even a small thing. You mentioned the Pacific Crest Trail. If you'd booked to stay at certain places and then all of a sudden your flight's delayed by a day, then everything on that trip is shunted by a day. And it might be that you can rearrange it all, but it might be that you're out for 10 or 15 hotels.
Yeah, I mean, that's what's called consequential loss. If you do everything yourself, if you book your own flights and you book your own hotels, you are essentially then being your own travel agent. So if it goes wrong, you've got to fix it yourself. No one else is going to help you. And no insurer is going to help you either, because you're the guy. You're the person who did it. If you booked it with a travel agent or a tour operator, though, they're responsible. So they've got to change it all for you. So although we all know that if you book an EasyJet flight and you book your hotel on hotels.com, it's going to be cheaper by 10% than booking it with a travel agent or a tour operator. But if you get to the airport and let's say, you know, the flights are all delayed because there's a European air traffic control dispute or whatever, and you're going to lose your hotel the other end, sure, EasyJet's going to refund you your flight, but the hotel's going to keep your money. Book it with a travel agent or tour operator. They're responsible for the performance of the itinerary. So it's called the package travel regulations. It's a Europe-wide law. I mean, although we're not in the EU anymore, our laws are still pretty much exactly the same as the EU. So I would always say book with a travel agent, but with, you know, the savings you get just aren't worth it when it goes wrong. And 1 in 10 times, it'll go wrong.
Been there and done that.
Exactly. Yes, so you know.
I think there are quite a few people who would use things like the comparison sites that you can find online. What would your advice be to somebody that is unsure of where to even start when it comes to booking insurance?
The thing to bear in mind about comparison sites, they only compare on price. So, and I read a report recently that only the top five insurance is listed on a comparison site when it comes up, and it's by price, are the ones that are purchased. Nobody goes to the bottom. If you're just doing a basic fly and flop, going to on a beach holiday, and you want the cheapest going, yeah, comparison sites are fine for that. But you may find you've got a massive excess. So if £250 excess, you can't claim for anything under £250. And it might be very restrictive in the cover it will give you. So I would say if you're doing something out of the ordinary, stay away from comparison websites. All you've got to do is if you go into Google and say trekking insurance, if that's the object of your holiday, and then Google with their AI and all the rest will list the insurance companies right underneath that offers trekking insurance. And then with most of the ones on there, you can put in, you know, the altitude that you're going to, and you can work it out that way. It's mountaineering likewise. You know, if you want mountaineering, specialist mountaineering insurance, if you are going to be climbing Everest to the top, for example, that's a very expensive policy, by the way, then you know, you can just put in mountaineering insurance and read through it from there. Price comparison websites is price only. As we put on our FAQs, if you're changing broadband, because broadband in this country is effectively all done by Openreach, which was the post office back in the day. They run all the cables. I mean, Virgin have got some in some areas now. So whatever broadband you're buying, it's essentially the same. It's just got a different badge on the outside of the modem. So if you after cheaper broadband, yeah, just go onto a price comparison website. So I do. But anything more than that, or anything where something is the same. I mean, car insurance, I used to go every year onto my car insurance to go on a price comparison website. And of course, then you look at some insurance companies you really never heard of, and it's a massive excess and it doesn't give you that. So you end up sort of working out where you were to start with. Just go into Google, trekking insurance, hiking insurance, walking insurance, and that's the best place to start if you're doing anything more than going for a beach holiday.
And I guess, is communication with the company important? I mean, would you, if somebody's confused about whether the coverage is right for them, should they just pick up the phone and call?
Yeah, absolutely. Or email them. I mean, I always think with any company I deal with, whether it's buying anything, how they communicate with you is extremely important. And it gives you a good gauge of how they're going to be if it all goes wrong for you. So give them a call, listen to the guy or girl you're speaking to on the phone. You know, if you're in a massive loop, you're in a massive call holding thing, and I will probably hold on for 2 or 3 minutes tops and then just give up and move to the next one. Or if you email them, see how quickly they email you back. if you go to a new cafe or restaurant and it's rubbish, you'll never go back there again. Now, unfortunately, with a cafe or restaurant, you've got to eat the meal to realise it and spend money with them before you walk away and decide, I'm not going back there again. But when you're buying over the phone or on the internet, anything, you can decide beforehand, actually, I don't feel particularly good about this. I'm going to try somewhere else. When you're buying it, go for the big names. In travel insurance, there's some big, you know, the post office is a big name. Everybody's heard of the post office. Stayshore, they're another big insurer, biggest in the UK, I think now, obviously us. So go for some sort of trusted names. If you come across a travel insurer, which you think, you know, you've never heard of them, the insurance company behind them, you've never heard of them, and the website looks a bit funny. A website can be sitting anywhere, in China, in Bangladesh, in Russia. So, you know, when you shop online, just think, do I know these people? And then, you know, make your own decision from there.
A full disclosure here, I always do get travel insurance, but I admit I am one of those people who books everything myself, which is, I guess, a bit of a risk. I tend to go for an annual package rather than for each individual trip, but it definitely does pay to get the right kind of insurance for whatever it is you're doing. Another strange but true story here for you. When I lived on the border between Canada and the US and my parents visited, they'd walk across the bridge pretty much every day for something to do. Once in the winter, my mum slipped on the ice and an ambulance from Canada and the US both showed up, and they argued over which side of the border had jurisdiction. I'm not exactly sure of the details of the argument, but apparently the US won that one, and the trip of less than a mile plus the treatment cost more than £1,000, and thankfully she was insured. If only she'd slipped about 10 feet to the north, it would have been in Canada. That crossing from Canada to the US and back, of course, involves having to show your passport at both borders. But there's a new passport that you don't need to show at a border crossing, or at least if you tried, you might get a strange look. You can still, however, get it stamped. It's the new and excellent Coast to Coast Path passport, which was recently launched and is already doing very well. You can get one online or early in the walk that starts in St. Bees, and then you collect stamps along the way to earn a Coast to Coast Path completion certificate. Thanks to the organisers of the passport, I have a copy of it and it looks absolutely great. To tell us about the idea and how it works is passport volunteer and director at Richmond Yorkshire CIC, Donald Klein.
Before we even talk about the passport, maybe you could give me a bit of background on the Coast to Coast itself.
Okay, yeah, I'm happy to. So my relationship with it, which is what sort of helped us think, yeah, that we need a passport for the Coast to Coast, is that in 1975, my wife started a bookshop in Richmond in North Yorkshire, where we've lived for 50 years. And very early on, we started taking Wainwright fell walking books, and they were published in Kendal by the Westmoreland Gazette. And all of a sudden, what became available was the Coast to Coast walk. And Wainwright published it in 73, so it hadn't been out very long. The Westmoreland Gazette were somewhat mean-spirited, so they wouldn't dispatch any books to anybody unless you came to Kendal and pick them up. So we would regularly drive over to Kendal and pick up the Coast to Coast. So that's how we got to know about the Coast to Coast. So from about 75 onwards, the popularity of it just increased and increased and increased. And my wife, Nina, in the bookshop, she'd have walkers who were planning this. This is, of course, pre-internet. And they would phone her or fax, if anyone can remember what a fax is. And, you know, they'd say, could you send me a couple of maps? And I don't know, Jim, whether you recall, but Ordnance Survey produced two very nice maps, an east and a west, or a west and an east, whatever you like, of the Coast to Coast. So we saw loads of those and we sent them all over the world. It was really, really good. And then at a certain point in the 90s, there was an accommodation guide to the Coast to Coast done by a lady who lived in Swaledale called Doreen Whitehead. And it was the same size as our passport is, the coast-to-coast passport. So it's A6 format. She did B&B, and she contacted all the B&Bs from St. Bees to Robin Hood's Bay, and she used to sell 5,000 or 6,000 of this little booklet every year. And we started working with Doreen, and we created a website which gave her accommodation and then allowed us online to sell the stuff. And that, again, was just hugely, hugely popular. So that's sort of how I got to do it, and that's how I got to know about it. And Richmond being the only place that Alf Wainwright suggests that you stop and have a rest because there's so much to see in Richmond, that in fact, this was the place where, you know, walkers would come in. And often what would happen, it was really quite funny, walkers would turn up at the shop and say, "Are you Donald? Are you Nina?" Whatever, you know, "I bought my maps from you." And so, and a lot of people, once they had a relationship with you, they would send you Christmas cards and, you know. And so this walking fraternity doing this coast-to-coast walk has been there for a long time, and we've had a connection with it.
Are there figures for how many? Obviously, not everybody's recorded, but are there figures for how many people do this every year?
Natural England, who are, as you know, and your audience will know, are upgrading the trail now, so it becomes a national trail, one of the national trails. They estimate 6,000 to 8,000 do it each year. And the passport has had such great reception from the national parks and a lot of the holiday companies and all the local authorities that cover the trail. So we've had funding for this from all these different organizations, you know, Cumberland Council, North Yorkshire Council, etc., that have made it possible, because the passport's done by a community interest company. So it's a not-for-profit venture. And we're all volunteers. We have a wonderful lady called Maggie, who is our administrator, but she only works a few hours each week, and she keeps all of the other volunteers straight. The holiday companies who support it, when we look at the numbers and we add them up, that's about the right number. So the companies who do a package on the coast to coast, so they move your bag from point to point, book your accommodation if that's what you want, we think they account for about 80% of the walkers that do it. But a lot of people, we had a couple of German walkers with their passports come in to the information center in Richmond the other day, and they were carrying everything on their backs. They'd booked all their own accommodation. So, you know, there's plenty of room for all different types of walkers, and they all seem to get on and be supportive of each other.
What do you think it is about the coast to coast that's so iconic? Do you think it's the Wainwright connection, or is it the concept of going from one side of the country to another?
I think it's that wonderful sense of achievement of going from the Irish Sea to the North Sea, 192 miles. And I just think there's something magical in terms of, you see it on the map and you think, oh gosh, is that northern bit of England, 192 miles. I wonder how much that is a day. And people start to think about it. And it's just become one of those, I would say for a lot of walkers, it's kind of a bucket list walk. And it has been the most popular UK walk, even though it's not a national trail, for years. Some of the other ones in the north have also done really well. Hadrian's Wall path gets big numbers because it's quite short. You can do it in, you know, 5 or 6 days or 7 days, something like that. Whereas the coast to coast, if you're going to do it at one go, is going to take you 14 days if you walk. Having said that, we have a lot of passport people who run it. You know, we had a couple of wonderful Swedes who did it in about 5 days. You know, I said, oh gosh, you know, that sounds like you were suffering. No, not at all. This was our vacation. You know. So,
surprised they had time to slow down enough to get the passport stamp.
They gathered 16 stamps across the way. That's the kind of compulsive nature of this, you know. Those of us of a certain age remember, you know, whenever you traveled, there wasn't a Schengen zone on the continent. So when you traveled, if your train went between France and Spain, besides perhaps having to adjust the size of the wheelbase or something, you know, the passport agents would come on the train in the middle of the night and wake you up and stamp your passport. So a lot of people really love this idea of stamping a passport. And it's not a unique concept. You know, there's one for Hadrian's Wall, there's one for the Southwest Coast, Northumberland Coast, the Pennine Way used to have one, Cleveland Way used to have one. The thing that's difficult is making them sustainable, and that's what we're really hoping the model that we've created will allow us to do. And the thing that's neat about it is there is this benefit. So the Wainwright Society have endorsed this and have put money into it as well. And there's a payback here, so that the profits that are earned from doing this will go back to support maintenance on the trail and also to the Wainwright Society. And we think possibly other walking organizations too. We just have to see how successful it is, you know. But we wanted to do it this year because all the improvements are happening now. They're just finishing the end of this year. And then they're going to have a huge launch for this. So with all that publicity next spring, if it's anything to go by, the other trails, when a trail has become a national trail and gained that status, the numbers of walkers have increased by 100% in a matter of a couple of years because there's just so much more publicity about it. So who knows?
Was it easy to coordinate in terms of getting all the stamp locations and the design, the layout, finding places that would accept stamps?
With all these things, and you'll know this yourself, and a lot of your listeners will know this, you have to build a critical mass. And so when you start, it's bloody difficult. Because the first thing people say to you, who else is doing this? And as soon as you say, well, you're the first one, they go, oh, yeah. Do I need to join this? Maybe not, you know. But once the momentum starts rolling along, it's been really, really quite straightforward. And what I would say is that we've had such great help from these funding organizations. So the North York Moors National Park, they have a liaison person called Georgia Tiffany. And this young woman is so great. And it's so important to the national park to have visitors who want to do outdoor stuff, you know, riding bikes. And they do a lot of mountain biking in one of the big forested areas in the park. And she very kindly sent a message around to all the businesses that have dealings with the park saying there's this new coast-to-coast passport. If you're in Grosmont or if you're in Egton Bridge or whatever, this might be of interest to you. And just on an email that this lady sent out, four or five people just said, it's for me. We didn't have to say anything to them. They just said, yes, we'd like to do it. And when people look at the website, c2cpassport.com, they'll see there's a section with the agents, and almost all the agents have a photograph of themselves with the passport. And they get ever so excited when somebody turns up and says, can I have a stamp in my passport? And they photograph, you know, put them on their Facebook page. And, you know, it's quite a contagious sort of thing. So to answer your question, it was hard to begin, but we probably did all of it in about 5 months. We got all the agent network set up in that period of time.
In terms of the concept, it's, as you said, a lot of places have a similar concept, but yours goes, I guess, a bit further in so far as it has information, it has discounts. How did you come up with the format?
Well, we thought that what we wanted to do, and again, this is this desire to make this self-financing. So this year we've had quite a lot of public funding and sponsorship. A lot of people have put just pure sponsorship money into it. That won't happen next year. So it'll have to stand on its own. So the way that we've done this is that the agents pay a stamping fee to become a stamper, and then they get a stamp and an ink pad, and all the stamps are individually designed for each of the 29 locations. So we thought to ourselves, we'll underwrite the cost of getting all those stamps designed and made up. And they paid £60. An agent would pay £60 to become an agent for 2025. And then if they had the opportunity, as you noted, if they wished to buy a little advert in the section. So if you're in Patterdale, you could buy an advert. There's only two agents in Patterdale. One of them is a guest house who doesn't really need to advertise. And the other one is the church. So, you know, and you could argue that Andrew, the vicar, could do with advertising, but he's put the passport stamp in the vestibule of the church. We have three churches. We have the Priory at St. Bees. We have Patterdale, St. Patrick's Church. We have another church just outside of Richmond at Mosque in Swaledale. And that's all self-serve. You know, you just come in and get your stamp. And there's several places like that. So there's quite a lot of variety. So that's one way of getting income to underwrite the costs of the design, the printing, et cetera. And then, of course, the other element of this is selling the actual passport. That generates the additional stream of income so that we can earn income off of that. And we also have people in St. Bees, because so many people this year doing the walk, they arrive in St. Bees. They know nothing about the passport. It's only been going for 6 weeks, you know. But the guest houses and the post office and some of the shops sell it. So they've got big signs on their windows saying, don't leave St. Bees without your passport. People go, what's that? They sell them. And the first place that you come to, Ennerdale Bridge, they also sell them, and they have stamps for both St. Bees and for Ennerdale. That's how we've done it. So there's those opportunities for people who know nothing about it. They arrive and they do it, you know. But that's really how it all works. So those two elements of income meet the costs. And ultimately, most of the directors of the CIC are superannuated old guys and women, you know. Our sell-by date's coming up is what I think I want to say, you know. So we wanted to try and get this working, and then that it should earn enough that we could effectively employ a couple of part-time people to help us administer the whole thing. And then it should just run itself. That's the whole idea.
It's 10 stamps to get the certificate. How did you decide on 10 as opposed to 25?
Yeah, well, the reality is a lot of people do the walk, and they're not going to have the time. You know, walking from, like as an example, from Ennerdale Bridge to over the Honister Pass into Burradale, that's a grueling day. You're not going to want to stop everywhere and get a stamp. You just want to keep putting one foot in front of another, you know. I hate to say it's like an endurance test, but, you know, they're really hard climbs. You know, some of the days are really difficult. So we just thought, what's a representative number? But to be honest, most people seem to be getting rather more than less. And even the people who do it, as I said, really quite quickly, they just have this compulsion for getting it, the stamps. And then they have this really nice memento of having done the walk. At the end, they just photograph the last stamp, Robin Hood's Bay. Each passport has a number in it. They just send us an email and attach a photo of that. And then we issue a completion certificate. That's the whole thing done and dusted.
So you don't have to cut out all of the stamps and send them in an envelope or anything?
No. You know, and to be truthful, you know, I mean, honestly, we say collect 10. The agents in Robin Hood's Bay, we thought we want them to validate each passport. They are so busy in the summertime. The Coast Guard station there, which is run by the National Trust, is one of the stamping agents. Walkers fall in there from whatever, early on a morning until they close at 5 p.m. or something. They don't have the time to go through a passport and check everything in detail. Some do, and they'll say, you know, they'll say, hey, you've done really well. You know, got a lot of stamps here. We're not trying to be like border control, you know.
Clearly, you're going to do this every year.
That's the plan. But, you know, we have to evaluate that. As I say, the nature of the CIC is that we have to effectively make a case for doing this. So what happens is that Community Interest Company, to your listeners who don't know what this is, what this beast is, it's different to being a charity. A charity has a very singular focus, and there's certain things that the Charity Commission will allow you to do. The CIC, the Community Interest Company, does lots of different things, but it reinvests the money that it earns in doing things of benefit to our own community, but more broadly across our ideas with the passport. What we do it's organized in Richmond, but what we do helps these tiny communities all along the track. That's the idea. And we hope that, yes, it'll be self-sustaining. That's the original idea.
It's only been around for a few weeks, but what's the reaction been like to it?
The reaction has been, I would say, 95% positive. We've had a few people have said, because it's 140 pages. So compared to Hadrian's Wall, the path for Hadrian's Wall is a little card. And so some people have said it's a little bit heavy. And, you know, we take those things on board and we'll see what we do with the next edition. as to whether we reduce the page count a little bit. But it turned out to be this because there was the demand from it, from the people who were supporting it. But for the most part, people have just absolutely loved it. And, you know, you get these wonderful photos of people with their passports and, as I say, stopping off somewhere and having a tea and getting their passport stamped. So far, that bit has worked really well. And so the criticisms are pretty minor.
And I'm sure that another thing that you could do with it being 140 pages is, I know it's quite sturdy and really well made, but maybe reduce the stock. That would reduce it.
You're right. We have used an uncoated paper on the inside because when you're stamping something, the ink needs to be absorbed by the paper. We could go a little bit slightly lower on the weight, and that would make a big difference. But we just wanted to make sure that when people had a stamp put in with a proper ink pad, that it didn't offset. You know, so when you closed it and then you opened it, you'd see the stamp on the opposite page, as it were. You learn by doing. This comment has been made 3 times, and so far I think we have sold about 700 passports. So there's been a pretty decent take-up of it, and I feel like, for the most part, I say people just have really enjoyed the experience. And a lot of people have said, oh, it's so great. This, in fact, we had one of the organizations that we work with who do a lot of the baggage transport, Sherpa Pack Horse, who have a big place in Richmond, but also in Kirby Stephen, and they move people's bags from location to location. I had an email from them the other day saying, we've had some customers from America who did the walk last year, and they found out that there's a passport. They want a passport. I said, well, it says 2025 on it. I don't have one that says 2024. Yeah, but they want it anyway. And they like certificates. And I said, oh, okay. It says 2025. So anyway, so we issued certificates. It's really been great. And those of us who've worked on it have really enjoyed it. And we feel like, particularly with the agents, most of them are really small businesses, you know, tiny shops and tiny cafes and stuff like this. And they've just so enjoyed the engagement. Places like Shap and Orton and Osmotherly, Ingleby Cross, Ingleby Arncliffe, these Danby Whisk, these are tiny little places on the track. And they just love seeing people, you know. And you constantly get comments from people saying, you know, I've walked so many of these trails, and far and away the Coast to Coast is my favorite. The people are so kind, so pleasant. So that's nice. It's Northern hospitality, Jim.
And I guess in this day and age as well, with social media, it's a very Instagrammable kind of thing to do, to put up pictures of you getting a stamp or of the stamps that you get as you go.
Yeah. And that is happening. So you register your passport. You know, you got this number, and you register it before you start to walk. And that way, when you get to the end, you don't have to tell us who you are. We know who you are. We can send you the certificate. You know, we don't have to go through all that rigmarole. It has been really interesting because once people do that, we then reply and say, thanks for registering, thanks for participating, etc. And we say, if you'd like to take pictures, this would be great. And at the same time, we say, if that's not your thing and all you want to do is just walk and enjoy the fresh air, please don't bother, you know. You make an offer to solicit in this way. But, you know, I would say probably only 50% of the audience that are using the passports bother to do this. I mean, some people get very excited about it, you can tell. You know, and partially, as I say, they'll have big followings of their own Facebook page, and they want everybody back home to know that they've got to Kirby Stephen and they had a good curry, you know, or whatever. So,
and you wonder also about, not that it is competitive, you wonder about the competitive nature of it, of people getting every stamp or as many as they can.
Yeah, possibly. So far, it's just been a great deal of fun. And I say, you know, everybody who's working with it, one of the volunteers who's sending out the passports increasingly now, who just lives up the road from us, you know, they're just on to it all the time. And they enjoy having an hour or so a day where they can just do all the paperwork related to this and go down to the post office in Richmond. And we send everything out using a really fast service, you know, so Royal Mail 48-hour tracked or a 24-hour tract. So the passports go out virtually the same day or the day after you order them. And people love that. They go, gosh, I wasn't expecting it so quickly, you know. So
One of the good things as well is that it's an entire community. I think walkers are generally open, honest, friendly, and it's just kind of expanding that family a little bit more, I guess.
Yeah. I think the thing that you really cannot understate for this particular walk, and I'm sure it's the same all over the country, but this walk has for 50 years been so important to the local economy of some of these northern towns. Kirby Stephen now, because it has two or three of the trails that are through it or close to it, the local economy there thrives on people doing these, like they're like, it's like a pilgrimage, you know, which one are you on? And you know, not everybody likes it, but for the most part, the community likes it. It helps to maintain jobs, you know, and keep people employed and stuff like that. So I think so long as it doesn't become like Venice, where you have to queue up in a queue to walk it, you know, and it's nothing like that. You know, you can walk all day and not see anybody, even in the height of the season. It's pretty wide open. So in other words, it has quite a lot of growth potential. The real problem is accommodation. And that's going to be the cap on how many people can do this, because a lot of the holiday companies can't find enough lodging and at certain times of the season to accommodate everybody. A lot of people who ran bed and breakfasts are of a certain age and they've just retired. You know, they finished. So I know in Richmond, about four or five guest houses have gone in the last, after COVID, you know, I mean, that wiped so many of them out. So that'll be a kind of a break on progress, I think. But we'll see.
We've seen a bit of a rise in things like Airbnb and more recently glamping. So
yes,
maybe there's opportunities there.
I think you're right. And there is, like, even close to Richmond, another a sort of a community-run hostel. It's on the other side of the River Swale, so it's not the same side that you're walking into town, but it'd be easy enough to get there. They've converted an old church to be another set of beds for coast to coasters and anyone else. It's great cycling country around here too, you know, so that's good.
And then you get the contrarians that start in Robin Hood's Bay and go west, but the passport would work for them as well. They just start at the back.
It would do, but there's two main carriers for bags. So Sherpa Packhorse and Brigantes, who are based in Derbyshire, and neither one of them transport going from Robin Hood's Bay to St. Bees. The logistics are just too difficult. That's another thing. So if you're going to do it, you're going to be carrying your gear. And we have seen some walkers who have come from Robin Hood's Bay this year. You know, we've seen a few.
And you've already mentioned the website.
There's a lot of information on this c2cpassport.com site about how it all works and stuff. And there's you know, one of these sort of flip books, so you can look inside it to see what some of the pages look like and stuff like that. We are hoping to, by the end of the season, have done a few short videos of walkers using the passport and stuff again, and add that to the site when the season's finished, I think, realistically, so that, again, people can see it in use, as it were. If people go on and they have an inquiry, you know, we get inquiries every day and one of us picks it up and answers the inquiries, you know. What we're not pretending to be is, there's so many, Jim, as you know, in your walking community, you know, there's so many wonderful websites given over to the coast to coast. We're not trying to emulate any of that. We're just talking about the passport and how the passport works. And actually, the forward is done by Julia Bradbury, who's a really well-known television personality, and she walked the coast to coast and did a program for the BBC a few years ago, which was really, really popular. She's written the foreword to this, which was nice. But in the preface to it, we say a lot of people don't do this at one go. They'll do it in two or three stages. Well, you can use the passport for two or three years. It doesn't time out on you. The only thing is that if you buy it this year and you finish it in 2030, some of the agents who were in it this year may not be in it then. And if one of our sponsors here in Richmond who have walking boots called Altberg, who a lot of your audience will know, it's a big British boot manufacturer. Altberg may not be offering 30% discount on a clean pair of socks. You know, I have no idea what the company will do in future years, but they're a great one to have on board as a sponsor, you know.
I know the passport is £15, but well worth the price, considering the discounts inside and also the information, plus those stamps. Keep your eyes out on walkingpost.com as well, because you will soon, hopefully, be able to get a good discount on the purchase price of that passport through a link at the top of the page. I also wonder if those passports will become collector's items. My son has a Lego passport, which you can take into any Lego store and they'll stamp it for you. I've taken that passport around Europe with me on my many trips and got him some quite interesting stamps. Of course, often the store is in a shopping centre outside of the city, making for some very long walks. But the point is, people actually sell these Lego passports on eBay. I've seen one with just a couple of stamps in go for £10, and one with more go for close to £50. Craziness. Well, that's it for the podcast, and that's pretty much it for May as well. It will soon be the longest day, unless, of course, you're listening to this in the Southern Hemisphere, in which case you're close to the shortest day. If you're on the equator, you can do what my wife and son do, and ignore what I just said. No idea who we have on the show next week, I need to really get on that. So I hope you have enjoyed this week's WalkingPost.com podcast, and I hope that you have a great week, hopefully with a walk somewhere, even if it is in the pouring rain. Until next time, happy trails! Walking Post from WalkingPost.com is an Air Coastal Media Limited production.